From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. We begin today with the story of an economic bubble. Or to be more precise, a mania.
Tulpen te koop, tulpen te koop, kopieer uw tulpen.
This mania took place in Amsterdam in the 1630s. Picture a city of canals, elegant townhouses, and a populace obsessed with one thing.
Tulpen te koop, tulpen te koop, kopieer uw tulpen.
Tulips.
Morgen het dubbele waard. Beste aankoop van uw leven. Tulpen te koop, tulpen te koop.
Amsterdam was the site of a big flowers market. It still is. People would trade tulips. And there were some tulips that were especially beautiful, they thought. And so people wanted those. And the price started going up.
This is economist Robert Shiller. And when he says prices started going up, what he means is they started going up a lot.
People were getting rich trading in tulips. One tulip would be the same value as a whole house.
One tulip could hold as much value as a house. Now, historians say they've only found a few examples of this, but even more modestly priced tulips could sell for what would today be thousands of dollars.
Tulpen te koop, tulpen te koop, beste aankoop van je leven, morgen. Dubbele waard, dubbele waard, tulpen te koop, tulpen te koop, tulpen te koop.
From a distance of nearly 400 years, the Dutch tulip mania of the 1630s might seem absurd. But the flowers were a way for the residents of Amsterdam to convey that they were cultured and influential. The tulips had great symbolic value. They told an amazing story. This week on Hidden Brain, the powerful way in which stories and psychology shape our economic lives. How narratives affect not just the purchases we make as individuals, but the fate of our entire economic system. Most people think of the economy as following a set of fairly scientific principles. I buy more if things are cheap. I buy less if they're expensive.
The nation's gross domestic product, or GDP, grew at a stronger than expected rate of 2.5%
during the spring quarter.
Or say I run a company.
I hire people if it looks like the economy is growing. I cut back if it looks like things are going to tank.
4% delayed hiring, 4% accelerated hiring. You can see there, mostly goods going down.
If I run the Federal Reserve, economic indicators tell me whether to raise or lower interest rates.
The central bank is cutting interest rates for the third time since July.
It all looks very rational, very mathematical. But this picture neglects a fundamental aspect of economic life. We live in a world of stories. The stories that we tell in news reports, around the water cooler, in conversations with friends and family, these stories profoundly shape the trajectory of the economy. Economist Robert Shiller's new book explores this idea. It's called Narrative Economics. The winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize in Economics, Robert Shiller says his interest in the relationship between stories and the economy goes all the way back to his early college days. He was an economics major, but he took a history course that examined the Great Depression. He was struck by the disconnect between the economic ideas he was learning about and the stories he read about how people behaved in the real world.
People didn't sound like the people described in my economic theory. They seemed to be faddish and vulnerable to crazes and new ideas, and then they drop them and forget them. It just seemed like there's a note of reality that has been lost when we separate out departments. A history department has something to offer. So does the psych and sociology department, etc. But we tend to be in academia, we tend to be polarized, or more than polarized, we tend to compartmentalized. And I've all my life ever since thought that I wanted to read what these other people were saying as well as what my economist people are saying.
Because, of course, they're all just different ways to understand the human condition, right? I mean, psychologists and anthropologists and sociologists and economists, I mean, they're all basically trying to understand why people do what they do. They're just using different tools.
And political scientists.
Yeah.
So we need all these perspectives. Don't be too compartmentalized. It may carry you for a while, but if you don't know what's happening in other realms of thought, you might miss the big picture.
Robert says these realms of thought can help us decode things that otherwise seem puzzling about the economy. Take, for example, the story of a paper written by a mysterious mathematician in 2008. The author went by a pseudonym.
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Who is Satoshi Nakamoto?
Satoshi Nakamoto is a fake name for somebody.
He's a myth. I mean, he doesn't, no one knows who he is. Some people have claimed to be Satoshi Nakamoto, but we have not seen any definitive proof.
When you ask about the creator, who created this, who invented this, they must be a real genius. Everyone's like, we have no idea.
The reason Satoshi Nakamoto created such a stir? This person, whose identity is still unknown, came up with a new type of currency, Bitcoin.
The first successful cryptocurrency. The story was that Nakamoto was able to invent a currency that could function without the help of any government, even against the opposition of any government.
Bitcoin emerged as the digital currency that in theory could not be manipulated by a central authority.
And it would be smart, young, cosmopolitan people all over the world who would secure this decentralized system. It's a wonderful story. And especially wonderful since nobody could figure out who Satoshi Nakamoto really was. he can't be found. No one has met him. How did he do that? It's an amazing story.
Robert makes the case that Bitcoin spread because it was a tale with surprise and intrigue. A genius mathematician invents a cryptocurrency and becomes a billionaire. It sounds like the plot of a movie. If I was making that movie, one subplot I would include is the story of the singer Lily Allen.
I wanna be rich and I want lots of money. I don't care about clever. I don't care.
Lily Allen received an offer to get paid for a performance in Bitcoin.
She turned it down. That was the most momentous error you can imagine, because she would be a billionaire if she had taken that Bitcoin.
And you know, you hear the story, and even if you don't know anything about cryptocurrencies, you ask yourself, am I missing out by not getting in on this?
Right.
I mean, the story induces FOMO.
That's exactly right, and that's a strong emotion, fear. It's regret theory. People are fearful of being regretful that they missed something. It hurts. You don't want to look forward to that pain in the future, so you might as well try. That's the thinking.
Mm. Well, what's astonishing is that the craze over Bitcoin spread, even though very few people actually understand what a cryptocurrency is or understand its underlying blockchain technology, but these terms very quickly became buzzwords. Here's comedian John Oliver on Last Week Tonight.
The problem is, there is now enough excitement around the very word blockchain that it's become a magnet for investment. Reuters found that existing companies that merely added the word blockchain to their name saw their stock price, on average, increase more than threefold. And one of them was particularly dumb.
Long Island Iced Tea renamed themselves Long Blockchain, and guess what happened? Yeah, their stock tripled.
Robert, so you write at one point that the total value of Bitcoin exceeded $300 billion, but Bitcoin has no value unless people think it has value. So something that existed purely in people's heads went from being worth $0 to $300 billion?
Yes, it can easily happen if the viral effect is strong enough. Now, so the Bitcoin enthusiasts will say, well, what about gold? Gold has no real value, just a shiny metal that you're pretty to look at, and yet it has tremendous value, and it has for thousands of years. But I have to say there's some differences. Gold is scarce, inherently scarce. Anybody can start a new cryptocurrency. Gold is in the Bible. It's mentioned over 300 times in the Holy Bible. Hmm.
You know, I was thinking about this as I was reading the book. You know, when I think about real money, obviously real money, you know, has on many occasions bought me real things. But at some level, doesn't real money function a little bit like Bitcoin in that it requires you and I to both agree that the notes that I have in my wallet have real value, that in some ways we both agree on the story of what the notes mean, and the story is what gives the notes their power.
That's right. You've spoken just perfectly about narrative economics. I'll give you another example, banks. Why don't banks fail? All it takes is a story. If someone says the bank is going to be bankrupt soon, everybody will rush in and try to take their money out, and the banks can't, they don't have it on hand. They can't pay it out. So that's another example of how, yes, our whole banking system is built on a narrative.
Yeah, because at any given point, the bank might have enough money, cash on hand, to basically pay out, you know, 5 or 10% of what its total assets are. It's investing the rest of the money in other projects. So if everyone asks for their money back at the same time, the bank would simply not be able to deliver.
And it happens. And it's supported by visual imagery. Photographers go to the bank and they take a photograph of the big crowd clamoring to get in to get their money out. This has happened so many times that the FDIC has a gallery of photos in one of their residences. And so it's become a narrative in itself that we have to watch out for, that it doesn't come back. It's a perennial narrative.
So Bitcoin was not just a mysterious new scheme. It tapped into many deep and ancient narratives about ordinary people and elites, about anarchy, about populism. Yeah. Talk to me about those larger themes that it tapped into.
Well, there was a movement that began in the 19th century with the philosopher Proudhon called anarchism, which took an extreme statement that we don't need any government. If we just leave the people alone with no government, they will do much better. People are naturally inclined, many people, to anarchism. And so they're so happy to hear Bitcoin, which was claimed can't be controlled by the government, because Bitcoin is for the whole world. It just sounds so enlightened and brilliant.
And in some ways, if you feel like you're part of the large number of people who doesn't have power, who doesn't have a voice, and you feel like powerful elites are running your life, as many people do, in some ways, Bitcoin is, it's sort of you're throwing a rock against the edifice of the elites. You're basically fighting back in some ways.
Right. And when you buy Bitcoin, you feel like you're on the bright side of things. You're an owner of some of this fancy computer stuff, in a sense.
Yeah.
And you're part of it.
Yeah, you're one of the disruptors. You're not the ones being disrupted.
That's the hope that it gives you, yes.
Robert says these underlying currents help explain why a story like Bitcoin took off. If psychology and sociology explain the origins of economic fads, Robert draws on ideas from another field, medicine, to understand how such fads spread and when they die. Stories, he says, function like viruses or parasites. They spread only when they have a receptive host.
It is really important to understand that things that are popular are the result of contagion. There's a contagion rate, which varies through time. There's also a recovery rate, how soon people forget about the narrative. This is just straight out of medical epidemiology. The contagion rate has to be higher than the recovery rate, and then the epidemic will take off. It'll start small, but it will get bigger and bigger until the contagion rate falls down below the recovery rate, and then it starts to recede. It's mysterious because we don't normally think about the contagion rate and the recovery rate for stories, but that, in fact, are basic parameters that explain when they get strong and when they fade away.
And of course, for the people who haven't invested in Bitcoin, who didn't get in on the craze, you know, those people might listen to this and say, hang on a second, I wasn't affected by the story. But in some ways, that's not different from an epidemic. Not everyone falls sick when an epidemic is raging.
Yeah. So if you have not invested in Bitcoin, that's not necessarily a sign of your common sense. It's just that you never encountered a contagious person who's spreading the word.
Robert, in your book, you write, when we choose to tell a story to others, we base that choice on our perceptions of how people will react to that story in their own minds. We will likely spread a story, whether it is a story about boomtime thinking or about economic despair, if we think that others will like the story enough to want to spread it further. Talk about this idea that part of the reason stories spread, and some stories spread more than others, is that we are actually, each of us, gauging whether if we tell the story to somebody else, they in turn would want to pass it on.
Right. Well, it's what psychologists call theory of mind. That is, we're always thinking about what we imagine other people are thinking. That's because understanding other people's thinking is very important for success in human society. People enjoy conversation. It's part of our species. It's everywhere in the world. Everywhere you go, you'll see people standing, facing each other, engaged in conversation. And if you get a translation of what they're saying, they're telling stories. And people, when they hear a story, they turn it over in their mind and say, maybe I could use this story in another conversation. So people evaluate them based on their apparent success in motivating other people. So yeah, it's as if people are all trying to go viral. It's not a new thing with the internet. They were going viral thousands of years ago.
Nearly a century ago, a powerful story swept the country. It's a story that has echoes in our own time, and the lessons from history are instructive. In the 1920s and 30s, many people feared that technological innovations were going to disrupt the economy and put lots of people out of work.
For the majority, it means the interminable line outside factory gates, desperately hoping for a job that rarely comes.
It explains some things that got out of hand and bad. The Great Depression of the 1930s came shortly after the term technological unemployment became popular in the late 1920s about machines replacing jobs.
Machines replaced hands. New machines replaced old machines. New inventions, the electric light, automobile, telephone, started as luxuries, then as they were made better and cheaper became commonplace.
And when the unemployment rate got high after 1930, people started to think, this is it. It's robots replacing our jobs. You may think it's pretty strange that people thought about robots in 1930. That sounds like long before they had computers. But they did think they had robots. I'll give you an example of what they called a robot. It's the dial telephone. Before that, when you picked up a phone, there was no dial, no keypad. You had to just, there was an operator there and it would say, number, please.
Number, please.
They replaced that operator with a machine. That's called a robot. And it scared people then. And they thought that maybe we better pull back and save some more money. When everybody does that, it makes the depression worse.
So one of the interesting points you make is that stories vanish and resurface, like the story you're just telling about technological innovation displacing workers. And sometimes these stories vanish and come back over decades or even centuries. And that really is analogous to what happens with pathogens that go dormant and then they reemerge sometimes decades later as epidemics.
That's right. And a pathogen can reemerge because of a mutation. Like influenza mutates quite regularly, and we have to get inoculated and imperfectly against those mutations. Or it can change because of some change in our practices. If there's some event that brings people closer together in an enclosed space, it can spread much more rapidly, and the contagion rate goes up. So these are fundamental lessons that I don't hear very often from most economists. They don't talk in these terms, and they don't see the causal impact from narratives to the economy.
If you turn on the news these days, there is a powerful story that's in circulation that tells us that a long period of economic expansion is soon going to be over.
Although things may look good for now, many Wall Street analysts are concerned about the warning signs
ahead.
Fluorescent
red recession warning light now flashing for the first time since 2007.
As a key predictor of recession,
read it and weep. If you're long this market, you were whipped and chilled by this market.
Warning signs flashing red that the economy could be headed for turmoil. The Dow closing over
800 points, losing 3% of its value.
What do you tell people when they ask you to predict the next recession? And by the way, that's me indirectly asking you to predict the next recession.
My feeling is that we are at a heightened risk of a recession. And having a recession before the 2020 elections in the U.S. might even be 50%. You'll see clear evidence of a recession coming. But I can't go above that. There will be another recession. We know that. But the other question that people tend to talk about all or nothing, will we or will we not have a recession? The question is, if there is another question, which I'd like to entertain, if there is a recession, is there a chance that it will develop into a severe recession? And I'm worried about that, even though I can't tell you precisely whether we'll be in a recession. And I think there are narratives today that might worsen a recession. Notably, the artificial intelligence narrative, which in an earlier form in the Great Depression, really did heighten the impact of the depression. Hmm. We could see that again, people becoming conservative in their expenditure because they're afraid of losing their jobs. I mean, it's already going on in some parts of the country, but it could become big.
I'm wondering if President Donald Trump might be a fan of your book, whether or not he's actually read it, because he clearly also believes in the power of stories. Here he is talking down the risks of an impending recession.
I don't think we're having a recession. We're doing tremendously well. Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut, and they're loaded up with money. They're buying. I saw the Walmart numbers. They were through the roof just 2 days ago. That's better than any poll. That's better than any economist.
So, Robert, given what you say about how talk can shape economic reality, is President Trump absolutely right to be spinning a positive story?
Well, I wouldn't use the word absolutely right. That's a little strong. But he is having an impact, I believe. It's not just his current spinning of the story. He's written many books with co-authors. These books have advice to be like him. He tells you how he did it. He tells you, for example, don't be afraid to boast about yourself because, you know, people are maybe a little resentful about boasting people. But in the long run, they believe in them because if you don't boast, nobody will hear about your successes. This is Donald Trump talking. He's telling you to spread your personal narrative aggressively. And he's been doing that for himself for 50 years. And it's worked.
Robert Shiller won the 2013 Nobel Prize in Economics. He's the author of Narrative Economics, How Stories Go Viral and Drive Major Economic Events. Robert, thank you for joining me today on Hidden Brain.
Shankar, thanks. It was a pleasure.
After the break, we take an anthropological look at the role that money plays in our society. Along the way, we challenge a popular idea about how the world worked before the invention of money. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to providing culturally enriching journeys along Europe's Danube and Rhine rivers, with a shore excursion included in every port. Learn more at vikingcruises.com. From Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can read reviews, book appointments, and check cost guides for home projects at homeadvisor.com or on the mobile app. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. There's a story we tell about what the world looked like before we invented money. It's a story built on the idea of barter.
This is the standard story that we read in the economics textbooks and that has been handed down to us at least since the mid-19th century, if not before.
This is anthropologist Bill Mora. He's the dean of the School of Social Sciences at the University of California, Irvine, and he studies the origins and nature of money.
And it goes something like this. In the beginning, before there was money, if I had something that you needed, I would approach you with that thing and see if you had anything that I needed. So if you wanted some fish and you needed some acorns and I had them, I could approach you with those acorns and we could basically barter on the spot, figuring out how many acorns equals how many fish. The problem with barter is it really does depend on us each meeting each other's needs in that moment. And so the origin story of money that we have is that humans invented money essentially to be a mediator in these sorts of exchanges.
In other words, if you, for example, had acorns, but I didn't actually want acorns, I wanted pots, for example, and I wanted to trade my fish for pots, and all you had to offer me was acorns, then essentially we couldn't negotiate. And economists sometimes have a term for this. They say that barter requires something called a double coincidence of wants. What is that?
The double coincidence of wants essentially means that in that moment, I've got what you need, you've got what I need. There's a coincidence of our needs in the instance. And that rarely happens, right? So the idea here is that humans wizard up this kind of third thing, money, this magical substance that can put all things on one scale of value, and use that as sort of their measuring stick then to make these kinds of transactions.
So there's a problem with the story, and the problem is that it runs into some facts. I'm wondering if you can tell me about the work that you and other anthropologists have done, for example, in the highlands of New Guinea, that call into question this origin story.
The problem is that when we look around the world and in the historical and archaeological record for instances of this kind of direct barter, unfortunately, we don't find it. What we find instead really are systems where people are taking some kind of object, let's take a kind of a big shell valuable in the highlands of New Guinea, and using it to mark relationships. They're using it to mark relationships among people, among kin, that serve as a kind of indicator of enduring obligations that people have to one another. It's kind of like an open-ended IOU, right? If I give you this big shell thing, then that implies for us, but also for everyone around us, that we have a bond, we have a relationship that will essentially allow us to have a flow of goods between each other and between our families for the rest of our lives, essentially. So it's not so much that I'm giving you this shell so that you give me some pigs. It's I'm giving you this shell so as to say, hey, someday I'm going to need some pigs. Some other day I might need your help in the field. Some other day you might need me to help you out with something. This shell kind of marks that relationship. It signifies to everyone around us that we have these ties of enduring obligation and responsibility.
So in other words, it's not about a transaction, at least not in an immediate sense. It's about a transaction that perhaps unfolds over time, more to do with obligation. My son is marrying your daughter. I'm giving you this precious necklace that I have. And my expectation is over the next 20 years, our families are going to help one another in all kinds of ways.
That's right. It's really a memory device to indicate an ongoing, enduring relationship, an ongoing set of obligations.
And is some of this connected with the more basic idea, if you will, of just gift giving? When you think about gifts, part of what we're doing when I'm giving you a gift, and presumably this is true for people all over the world in different cultures, the gift is partly my telling you here's something nice for you, but it also binds us in some kind of relationship that says, down the line, you know, it's not explicit, but there's some implicit understanding that you're going to do something nice for me down the road.
This is exactly how it works, yeah. And the early anthropologist Marcel Mauss wrote about this quite explicitly, saying that in the gift, there's the obligation to give, there's the obligation to receive, but then also the obligation to reciprocate.
This obligation to reciprocate can be seen across human societies and across time. Some years ago, Bill stumbled on another interesting example of this. He was in Washington, D.C., visiting a colleague who worked at the Smithsonian. She curated the museum's collections that relate to the history of money. Bill was with her inside a vault.
And there's an area in the vault in a kind of long closet. And she and her interns call it Narnia because it's sort of like the wardrobe in Narnia. You go in and it goes on and on and on forever.
Inside this Narnia, there are boxes upon boxes of uncatalogued artifacts.
So I was there once with her and she said to me, do you want to go to Narnia? And I said, sure. So we go in, pull out a box at random, bring it out. She opens the box, and there's a ton of these clay tablets covered in cuneiform. And there's a sort of moment where both of us back away from the box. You know, and I'm like, uh-oh, don't touch anything, don't break anything, don't breathe.
The clay tablets that they pulled out of the box were used 5,000 years ago in ancient Mesopotamia. They were used to keep records of obligations. When people lived in small groups, monitoring obligations was easy. I just remembered what you had said and done, and you remembered what I had said and done. But as human societies grew larger, people needed a way to systematically keep track of who owed what to whom.
And we just can't keep track of all of that in our heads. What emerges essentially are systems of public administration where you've got centralized authorities who are responsible for organizing irrigation, organizing production so that you can have these larger scale settlements. who set up systems of record keeping, in the case that you mentioned in Mesopotamia, using clay tablets, so that people basically know what's going on, who's doing what, who owes what to whom. And you don't have the situation of something like a coin circulating from hand to hand to pay your laborers, for example. Instead, you have these systems of tablets that are basically receipts keeping track of things like labor and then promising that, you know, after a certain period, if the labor has been done, the laborer is entitled to X. In a lot of our ancient Mesopotamian receipts, it's things like beer and grain and livestock. This isn't a market the way that we traditionally understand markets, right? It's not sort of the idea that people come together in a place and exchange goods either by barter or by money. This is much more a kind of hierarchical system of organization to essentially allow for the creation of these larger scale societies.
So you've talked about this idea of centralized administration, and in some ways this brings us to another aspect of our story. We've talked a little bit about the idea of gift giving and mutual obligations. We've talked about the idea of receipts and record keeping and essentially, you know, basic contracts that sort of bind us to one another over time. But talk also about this idea of the central administration of these systems and the introduction of what eventually become, authorities that basically are overseeing how the whole system works.
So to make a money work, you need something that is both that system of reckoning and record keeping, but also an authorizing power that says, in effect, this is the way that we keep our records here. So even in, you know, the highlands of New Guinea, and then again in Mesopotamia, you've got both of those things going on, the system of record keeping and the authorizing force. And that's essentially what we have with modern money still today. We don't necessarily think of it that way. But basically, money is a unit of account that, in our case, is authorized by the state. The state essentially sets the standard, and then that standard is used by people to reckon their relationships with one another, figure their debts and credits.
So the story that emerges about the origins of money is very different than the way we often think about it. In this model, embraced by Bill and other anthropologists, money is partly a mechanism of social obligation and partly a mechanism to keep track of who owes what to whom. It's also a mechanism that cements the relationship between ordinary people and authorities who maintain records. In turn, the relationship between ordinary people and authority figures produces the next phase in the story of money, the invention of taxes.
So in most of these systems, what you see is the development of something like a tax or a tribute or a tithe, where a thing is sort of put out into the world. It can start off with just being, you know, grain or something like that. But often what happened in ancient societies is rulers would take something that symbolized their own elite status, usually precious metal, and send some of it out into the world and say, here, you know, you get this in exchange for serving in my army, or you get this as a token to hold on to remind you that you are subject to my rule. And in return, on some regular cycle, every year, every 7 years, you're expected to bring some of that back to me to demonstrate your fealty, to demonstrate your loyalty. And in effect, what we get is the origin of the first coins, things that look like coins to you and me, that are really serving as these kind of political tokens that express sovereignty. So I would get one of these things, and then I'm obligated at some point to, you know, get one of them or some of them back to you. That instantly creates a market in these things. Everybody has to get their hands on these new tokens of political authority in order to give some back to the center.
So one of the interesting things to consider here is that there might be actually different competing ideas about the nature and origin of money. You know, one of them says it's transactional, it's functional. This is sort of what you learn in Economics 101. The model that you're painting is that this is much more about relationships and mutual obligations and histories of those obligations and how those are recorded and preserved over time and the state authorities that might be involved in preserving them and their relationship to you and so forth. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what happened when these different systems, if you will, clashed with one another. You've talked about how when European colonists went to Africa and Asia, in some ways they encountered different systems than the ones they were used to. And in some ways you had not just a clash of people and a clash of civilizations, if you will, but a clash of how you define what money actually is during these encounters.
Europeans consistently misidentified things like shells or metal rods or bracelets and things like that around the world as the kind of money that they were used to. And so what would they do? Well, you know, one thing that they would do is they would forcibly introduce their own standard, a kind of typical means of colonization and subjugation in sub-Saharan Africa, was to demand that colonized people pay taxes in European money, right? That then meant that they had to get that European money, which meant that they would have to do things like grow crops or sell things or engage in the slave trade or something like that that would generate that money they could give back. Or in other cases, European powers would just reset the standard by saying, you know, these shells before were good, but this other shell is better, and we're going to demand our taxes in this other shell. Again, similarly setting up a market in these other shells, which then completely contorted the societies that were subject to colonial rule.
So it's interesting. Money in some ways was a tool of colonization.
Absolutely. I think money has always been a tool of political authority.
Bill says political authority is drawn not just from issuing money, but from the act of designing it. The images you see on a bill or a coin can say a great deal about a nation's values and aspirations. In 2015, the Treasury Secretary invited Bill and other scholars to Washington, D.C. They were to discuss a proposed redesign of the $10 bill.
I was invited to come and just have a kind of brainstorming session about the kinds of things that you could do on a banknote, the kinds of stories that you could tell on the money about the nation, and the ways those stories could make people feel included in the nation in a new way.
Again, this was happening in 2015. That was the same year that the musical Hamilton debuted on Broadway.
His financial system is a work of genius. I couldn't undo it if I tried. And I tried.
And it reminded everyone of the role that Alexander Hamilton played in establishing our banking system.
The figure on the 10 currently is Alexander Hamilton, and then we thought maybe we want to keep him.
So Bill and the group decide that instead of redesigning the $10 bill, they should update the 20.
Since the 20 is a more ubiquitous banknote, it's the one that comes out of all the ATMs. It's much more common in people's daily transactions than the 10.
The image of Andrew Jackson, the 7th president of the United States, has been on the $20 bill since 1928. Jackson's tenure was marked by the signing of the Indian Removal Act, which resulted in the deaths of thousands of indigenous people. Bill and other members of the group in Washington felt a woman should take Jackson's place. They gravitated toward a hero of the Underground Railroad.
There was really strong consensus around Harriet Tubman, in part because having her on the bill would help to sort of, you know, sketch and then complete a story arc about American society, about increasing the franchise, about emancipation, about the civil rights movement. That's kind of really where our minds went, because we started thinking about all of the stories that you can tell on this thing that really is still one of the most ubiquitous forms of mass media in the United States.
The announcement about the $20 bill redesign was made in April 2016.
Harriet Tubman, who helped more than 300 slaves find freedom through the Underground Railroad, will be the new face of the $20 bill. Tubman will be the first woman featured on the front of U.S. currency in more than...
Andrew Jackson would remain on one side of the bill, and Harriet Tubman would be on the other. The rebranding was announced during President Barack Obama's final year in office. Then presidential candidate Donald Trump called the decision pure political correctness. He was asked about the redesign on NBC's Today Show.
I think Harriet Tubman is fantastic. I would love to leave Andrew Jackson and see if we can maybe come up with another denomination. Maybe we do the $2 bill.
Less than a year after the redesign was announced, Donald Trump became president. In the Oval Office, he hung a portrait of his favorite predecessor. It was Andrew Jackson. And in the summer of 2019,
Andrew Jackson is keeping his place on the $20 bill for now. That's according to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, whose department oversees the design of currency.
The Trump administration tabled the redesign just months before the bill was expected to be released.
The ultimate decision on the redesign will most likely be another secretary's down the road.
So it seems like the project is on hold right now, and we'll see how things develop. Regardless, the notes will have to be redesigned because of the overriding reason for which they're redesigned, which is anti-counterfeiting. So we'll see what happens.
The faces and scenes we see on our money communicate our values as a nation. And the way we use that money communicates something about us as individuals. When I give you money, I'm not just giving you a piece of paper. I'm giving you my word, my bond.
Society is a thing of ongoing, continuous relationships and unsettled debts, right? The settling and unsettling of debts on and on and on and on and on.
Stay with us. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. From MindBody, where wellness and people meet, with thousands of fitness classes to find and book in one place, studios can list their business at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Some years ago, economist Joel Waldfogel wrote a paper titled "The Deadweight Loss of Christmas." He argued that it made no sense for me to give you gifts that you don't like and for you to give me gifts that I don't like. We would both be better off keeping our money and spending it on the things we do like. Anthropologist Bill Maurer has many disputes with how economists see the world of money. Joel Waldfogel's argument might be ground zero.
I think one of the things that economists are always imagining is that the end of transactions is to have them settled, right? That we enter a relationship of debt, and then we want to settle that debt. So you hand me over something at the store, and I give you money at the till, and then it's over, and then we go our separate ways. They love that kind of vision of the frictionless market where parties come to the market anonymously, and money is the thing that mediates their relationship so that then they continue to go on anonymously. The problem is that if you imagine a world where all debts are settled, then what is that world? That's a world then of no more relationships, of no more mutuality, of no more obligation. Society is not a society of settled debts. Society is a thing of ongoing, continuous relationships and unsettled debts, right? The settling and unsettling of debts on and on and on and on and on. There's no moment where it ends, or at least if there was a moment where it ended, we'd all just be alone in bunkers, hiding, doing nothing.
So I'm wondering if this is connected to some very interesting phenomena that we see, which is that even after coming up with this remarkable invention, money, we've also come up with lots of ways to make money inefficient and difficult to use. So we give our friends gift cards to restaurants that limit in some ways how they can use the money. In some ways, it would be easier just to give them cash and they could use it at the restaurant or not use it at the restaurant. What do these inefficient forms of money tell us about the role that money plays in personal relationships?
Yeah, I love this kind of stuff because it really shows you that money is never purely fungible, right? We're continuously putting boundaries around different pots of money. And those boundaries are often moral boundaries. They signify a moral or ethical or relational stance that we want to take with respect to one another. And this kind of earmarking of money for special purposes, this kind of sequestering of some money, taking it out of circulation and keeping it in a special place for only a special purpose, really does help us make the stuff of social life, helps us stitch ourselves together and bind us to one another in ways that far exceed the imagination of money as just a neutral medium of exchange.
The tensions between these two models of money, between the economist model and the anthropologist model, exist within each of us. We couldn't function as economic actors without the capacity to think of money as a neutral form of anonymous exchange. Of course, all of us also intuitively understand how debts and obligations work, and we sometimes become uncomfortable when these two models collide with one another. For example, we have struggled for decades with the challenge of time-consuming and difficult activities like parenting or domestic work or caring for aging parents. Should we think of these things as jobs? Put a dollar figure on them? Or should some things exist outside the sphere of money?
This is kind of a paradox of you know, modern subjects in contemporary Western societies, is that, you know, we think of ourselves as individuals first and members of relationships second, even though, of course, it's only through relationships that we get formed, right? We forget about those relationships, and when those things are brought forward, we feel sometimes a little ugh about them, right? I don't want to be that. I don't want to have that connection. I don't want to be tied to you.
Bill, I understand that you have a somewhat unusual living arrangement, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about it, then talk about some of the relationships that are embedded in your housing.
Sure. Okay, disclaimer, I am not a hippie and we are not a tribe, but I live with my partner and another married couple. There are four of us together, and the other couple has a young son. And before their child was born, we became very close friends. We were living a few blocks away from each other. We ended up kind of eating at each other's houses every night, you know, a kind of close little network of friends. And I live in Southern California. It's very expensive. We are four professionals, but even with four professional salaries, we felt that, you know, we couldn't necessarily have the kind of house that we wanted. So we thought, you know, we're kind of eating together all the time anyway and doing everything together. Let's buy a house together. And, you know, sometimes you just sort of make these decisions and you don't know if they're good or bad or what. Right. But we jumped in. We spent, you know, a year looking for a place with sort of two flats, but with an interior staircase. So it feels more like one big house. They gave birth to their son, Carter, and we all moved in together. And we've been living together now for, I guess, 13 years, maybe more. And, you know, as someone who sort of studies money and economic relationships, if I take a step back and look at my own situation, it's kind of interesting because we don't actually have any kind of internal system of accounting. We own the house as tenants in common. We share the mortgage, so we split the mortgage down the middle. At tax time, we split the interest down the middle for filing our taxes. But other than that, we're basically sharing all of our expenses and just kind of living that way. There's no mental accounting, really. There's no, you know, I paid for the groceries this week, so you do it next week. We're just comfortable doing that and operating as a kind of larger economic unit. And yeah, I mean, we really are kind of living in a sort of alternative economic arrangement that's based on these, you know, close, I think you could almost call them kin relationships that we've established together. And in many ways, like the house is the symbol of those relationships, right? I mean, the house is our shell valuable, right? It's the thing that signifies that connection.
So what's so interesting about this arrangement is in some ways it speaks to what you said some time ago about the difference between the way economists want to think about transactions and the way that you're describing them, which is that if you want to live in a world where the transaction is over, you know, you give me something, I pay you something, we shake hands, we never see each other again, that is not the system that you have set up for your housing, right? Because the system that you've set up is a system in some ways of indefinite debts and obligations that are constantly being created and repaid. You're constantly engaged in gift giving, gift taking, but that binds you in some ways in a web of obligations that I'm hearing you say in some ways has worked very well for you.
It's worked very well. you know, we actually had an anthropologist want to come live with us. I said no. She's like, I would really love to study this. This is fascinating. No, you can't live in our house.
So in other words, the anthropologist doesn't like it when other anthropologists come in and want to study the first anthropologist.
The anthropologist finds it amusing when others want to do so.
Bill Maurer is an anthropologist at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author of How Would You Like to Pay? And other works about the nature and origin of money. Bill, thanks for joining me today on Hidden Brain.
Thank you so much, Shankar. I've enjoyed it.
This week's episode was produced by Parth Shah and Thomas Liu and edited by Tara Boyle and Jenny Schmidt. Our team includes Laura Quirrell, Raina Cohen, and our intern, Lushik Waba. If you like today's show, please subscribe to our podcast. Search for Hidden Brain on your preferred podcast app. I'm Shankar Vedantam. See you next week.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can read reviews, book appointments, and check cost guides for home projects at homeadvisor.com or on the mobile app. And from the NPR Wine Club, where every bottle tells a story, and NPR shows become wines like Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon, available to adults 21 years or older. Learn more at nprwineclub.org.